8. Monastery of Saint Zeno, City of Tellisberg, Kingdom of Old Caris. It was raining gently for a Tellisberg afternoon as Father Peter Wilson knelt in the kitchen garden of the Monastery of Saint Zeno. He felt his plain, borrowed habit growing progressively heavier with moisture as the blowing mist washed over him, but he didn't care. In fact, he treasured it. It wasn't a cold, drenching rain after all. More like a caress. Possibly even a kiss from God's world, he thought with a touch of whimsy, as his muddy hands extracted weeds from neat rows of staked tomato vines and the warm, earthy, growing smell of wet leaves and rich, moist soil rose about him like the Archangel Sondheim's incense. It had been too long since he'd done simple work, he thought. He'd been so wrapped up in his duties and his responsibilities, his probably arrogant belief that so many critical things depended upon him, that he'd forgotten even the greatest and holiest man imaginable, which he most decidedly was not, was only one more worker in a far greater worker's garden. If St. Zeno's had done no more than remind him of that simple fact, he would still have owed Archbishop Michael and Father Zon enormous thanks. But that wasn't all St. Zeno's had done. He moved forward a few feet to reach a fresh batch of weeds and raised his face to the tiny, delicate fingertips of the rain. He had two more rows of tomatoes to do, and then the squash. That was going to be more of a penance, since if there was one vegetable he detested, it was squash. I suppose it's proof of the Archangel's workmanship that they created people to be different enough that there's somebody to like every edible plant, he thought. I'm not too sure why they wasted the effort on squash, but I'm sure it was part of God's plan. I'm not so sure a taste for Brussels sprouts was, though, come to think of it. He smiled and raised a clod of wet earth in his fingers. He looked down at it and squeezed gently, compressing it into a smooth oval, and for the first time in far too long he felt another, far greater hand shaping his own life. "Well, what do you think?" Father Zon Birkett asked. He sat gazing out the window at the red-haired youthful priest pulling weeds in the monastery's garden. The young man seemed oblivious to the gently falling rain, although Birkett doubted that was the case. In fact, from how slowly and carefully Father Peter was working, Birkett suspected he was actually enjoying it. "You know my opinion," Father Abel Zastro said. "I was inclined in his favour before he ever arrived, and I've seen nothing to change that opinion." Father Abel was the abbot of St. Zerno's, title Birkett had held until fairly recently. Age was paring away Birkett's strength, however. In fact, he was fading visibly, although he seemed less aware of the process, or less concerned by it at any rate than anyone else. He'd been forced to give up his duties as abbot because of failing health, but he retained the office of librarian, which was arguably of even greater importance and responsibility, given the peculiarities of the Order of St. Zeno. "I've come to think highly of him myself," Brother Bartolome Foyer said. The almoner, in charge of feeding the poor in St. Zeno's neighbourhood, was brown-haired and brown-eyed, broad-shouldered and powerfully built, with a battered pugilist's face, which hinted only too accurately of his youthful life as a waterfront loan shark's enforcer before he heard God's call. Now that face wore an anxious expression, and he shook his head slowly. "I've come to think very highly of him," he continued, "but I can't quite forget he's an inquisitor. Everything I've ever heard of him, far less what we've seen while he's been here, shouts that he's nothing at all like Clintan or Reno. But he's still an inquisitor, raised and trained as a Schulerite, and we've never admitted a Schulerite to the inner circle. There was a reason for that, and I just can't convince myself we should set that rule aside if we don't absolutely have to." Bartolam has a point, Brother Simon Sharman said. As the monastery's hosteler charged with serving the needs of the homeless and seeing to the well-being and comfort of St. Zerno's guests, he and Foyer worked closely together every day. They didn't look very much alike, though. Sharman was grey-haired, slender, and at least 15 or 20 years older than Foyer, with a thin face and a scholarly look. "He has a point," he repeated. "Oh, there was never a hard and fast rule about Schulerites, but there was certainly agreement." He made a wry face, and Birkett chuckled. "All the same, Bartolam," Sharman turned from the window to face Foyer fully. "We've discarded a lot of other rules, including rules which were hard and fast over the last couple of years. We haven't set any of them aside without good reason, yet set them aside we have. I'll agree that the mere thought of letting an inquisitor anywhere near the journal is enough to set my teeth on edge. But I'm inclined to support Zone and Abel on this one."
"You are?"
Foyer looked surprised, and Sharman shrugged. "Not without someone showing me a very good reason to, I assure you. But I think Michael's almost certainly right about this young man. For that matter, I remind all of us that Michael's judgment of someone's character is usually frighteningly acute. Everything I've seen of Father Pater only confirms what Michael's told us in his case at any rate, and Michael and the others are absolutely correct about the huge advantages inherent in bringing this particular inquisitor over to the truth. But those very advantages would become equally huge disasters if it turns out Michael isn't right in his case after all," Sister Ame Bayland pointed out. "If Sister Ame, more properly Mother Abbess Ame, was perturbed by the fact that she was the only woman present, it wasn't apparent. For that matter, she'd been a frequent visitor at St. Zerno's over the years. The Abbey of St. Evelyn was St. Zerno's sister abbey, although it had been founded almost 200 years after St. Zerno's. Sister Ame was a petite, slender woman, with delicate hands, an oval face, brown hair, and a strong nose. She limped from a left leg, which had been badly broken when she'd been younger, and damp weather, like today's, made it worse. Her brown eyes were shadowed with more than the aching discomfort of her leg as she looked out the window with the others, however.
Trust me, Ame, we're all painfully aware of that," Brother Terence Bazaire, St. Zerno's treasurer, said wryly. His brown hair was sprinkled with white, and he rubbed the scar on his forehead with one finger, brown eyes intent as he too watched the oblivious young priest working in the garden. "The fact that, unlike so many other intendants, he's never been capricious, that he's always been fair and compassionate would be enough to give him a commanding stature all by itself," Bezier snorted. "After all, we're all so unaccustomed to that sort of behaviour out of any Schulerite, and especially out of an intendant. But then there's the fact that Schulerite or no, inquisitor or no, I've never heard anyone accuse him of speaking a harsh word, and all of old Caris has seen the faith that carried him through the silence about his family after his father's death. Then add in the fact that the Wilson family's always had a reputation for piety, and the fact that he's now the son and nephew of two vicars who were martyred by that bastard Clintan, and you get a package that could do us all incredible damage if we tell him the truth and he doesn't believe it."
"It could be even worse than that, Terence," Foyer pointed out. "What if he does believe the truth, and it destroys his faith in God completely?" All of them looked at one another silently. Then Birkett nodded. "We've been lucky in that respect so far," he said heavily. "But sooner or later, we're going to be unlucky. We all know that. That's the reason we've recommended against telling so many candidates we know are good and godly people, and we know all that too. And whether any of us wants to talk about it or not, we also know what Caleb and Charlian and Merlin will find themselves forced to do if it turns out we've told someone and it was a mistake." He leaned back against the wall, regarding all of them steadily. "I'm an old man. I won't be party to making these decisions very much longer, and I imagine I'm going to be giving account to God for the decisions I've helped make sooner than the rest of you are. But none of us can pretend we don't recognize the stakes we're playing for, or that Caleb and Charlian can't afford to be anything but ruthless if it turns out we've told someone who will use that knowledge against us. And let's be honest, simple outrage, the kind of outrage the best of men are most likely to feel, would be all the reason anyone would need to proclaim the truth from the highest mountain. Of course, it would probably get him killed very quickly. But how likely is that to be a factor in the thinking of someone like that? So, as I see it, the real question here isn't whether or not Father Peter is a compassionate, loving servant of God, but whether we want to take the chance of being responsible for the death of a compassionate, loving servant of God, if it should happen that his outrage upon learning the truth makes him a threat to everything we're trying to accomplish." The others looked back at him in fresh silence, and then, as one, they turned to look back out the window at the young man kneeling in the borrowed habit, pulling weeds in the rain. "You weren't joking when you said you liked salad, were you?" Peter Wilson looked up from his second large serving of salad and smiled at Brother Bartolam. "Oh, I've always liked it," he said cheerfully. "I've discovered that when I'm personally responsible for exterminating the weeds and beating off the attacks of one bug or another, the tomatoes taste even better, however. And your brothers make one of the best balsamic dressings I've ever tried. Has the monastery ever considered marketing it? I'm sure you could raise quite a bit of revenue, and I've never heard of a monastery that couldn't use more funds for charitable works." "That's true enough," Brother Terence put in. "St. Zerno's had no rule of silence, especially at meals, and the treasurer chuckled as he sat back on the bench, running down the other side of the long, brilliantly polished refectory table. "And St. Zerno's is no exception to the rule either. You may have noticed, we're not exactly swimming in charitable bequests, Father." "As a matter of fact, I had noticed," Peter replied. He looked around the large, lovingly maintained and painstakingly clean dining room, then back at Bézère. "I don't believe I've ever seen a more beautiful monastery, brother, and I've seen evidence enough of the good you do in this neighbourhood. But if you'll forgive me, it's obvious the monastery could use some improvements and overdue repairs." "Well, I'm sure you've also noticed that unlike most monasteries, we're very small," Bézère responded. "Our opportunities to engage in revenue-generating crafts, or even to support ourselves with something larger than our kitchen garden, are limited, to say the least. And, alas, our neighbourhood, as you put it, lacks the resources to support even itself, much less us." He smiled gently. "That, after all, is the reason we're here. That, and to provide a place where any of our brethren who need it can find a spot to catch his breath," Father Abel said, entering the conversation and smiling at Peter. "Or, for that matter, where someone recommended by one of our brethren can catch his breath. To be totally honest, that's really the primary reason for our existence, Father. Oh, the work we do is eminently worth doing, and the people among whom we do it are as worthy and as needful as any of God's children. But the truth is that in some ways St. Zerno's is actually, well, selfish would probably be too strong a word, but it's headed in the right direction. We offer a place where people who get too caught up in the breathless, everyday race of trying to see to God's business in his world can step back and put their hands to his work for a time instead, where they can participate in the simple pastoral duties that called them to God's service in the first place. That's one reason the Brethren of St. Zernot make no distinction between the other orders. We're open to Bedardists, Pasquilettes, Langhornites. He shrugged. I'm sure you've seen representatives of almost every order during even your relatively brief stay with us. Yes, I have, Father, Pater replied, but his eyes had narrowed, and he sounded like a man picking his words, possibly even his thoughts, with care. I've noticed, and I've also noticed that I've seen no Schulerites. No, you haven't. If Zastro was taken aback by Pater's observation, he showed no sign of it. Instead, he cocked his head to one side and smiled gently at the younger priest. However, Father Pater, you've probably seen many more Schulerites than I have. I mean no disrespect, but do you really think the majority of them would find the atmosphere of St. Zernot's congenial? Probably not, Pater acknowledged, and shook his head sadly. I think my father and Uncle Horwood would have. But you're right about most of the order, I'm afraid. Which rather leads me to the question of why Archbishop Michael thought this would be a good place to send me, I suppose. I won't presume to speak for the Archbishop, Zastro replied, but it might be because you're not very much like the majority of Schulerites. Again, I mean no disrespect to your order, Father, but it seems to me there's a rather authoritarian mindset to much of what it does. I'm inclined to think that's probably inevitable, given the nature of the Inquisition's duties, of course. But I hope you'll forgive me for pointing out that you, and from what I've heard, your father, believe the basis of true discipline has to be love, and that it must be tempered by compassion and gentleness. And from what I've seen of you during your visit with us, that's almost certainly what drew you into the priesthood in the first place. For that matter, he looked directly into Pater's eyes. It's also the reason you were so angry when you first came to us, isn't it? The question came so gently, it took Pater almost completely unawares, and he found himself nodding before he'd even truly digested it. Yes, it is, he admitted. Archbishop Michael recognized that before I was willing to admit it even to myself. And you and Father Zon, all the brothers, have helped me to realize just how foolish that was of me. Well, now I suppose that depends in part on the reasons for your anger, Birkett said. The librarian had come into the room from behind Pater, and the intendant turned on his bench as Birkett made his slow and creaky way across the floor, leaning heavily on a cane. Pater started to get up to offer his own place, but the librarian rested a gnarled hand on his shoulder and shook his head. Oh, stay where you are, youngster. If I decide I need somewhere to sit, I'll move one of these other idle layabouts out of my way. In fact, he poked Foyer with the end of his cane, and the far larger and far younger almoner rose with a chuckle. Have to check the kitchen, he said, elevating his nose, which, of course, is the only reason I will so meekly yield my place. Oh, we all know how meek you are, Birkett said. Now run along. I need to talk to young Pater. The writ devotes a great deal of attention to the tyranny of power, Foyer observed to no one in particular. I wonder why it gives so much less attention to the tyranny of old age. Because it's not tyranny. It's just an excess of common sense. Foyer laughed, touched Birkett affectionately on the shoulder, and took his leave as the librarian settled his increasingly frail bones into the vacated spot. As I was about to say, he continued, turning back to Pater, whether it's foolish to be angry or not depends on the reasons for the anger, and who it's directed at, of course. Being angry at God is fairly foolish when you come down to it, which I suppose is the reason all of us spend so much time doing it, whether we realize it or not. but being angry at those who pervert God's will, or who use the cover and excuse of God's will to impose their own wills on others? He shook his head, ancient eyes bright as they gazed into Pater's. There's nothing foolish in that, my son. Hatred is a poison, but anger, good, honestly come by anger, the kind that stems from outrage, from the need to protect the weak, or lift the fallen, or stop the cruel, that's not poison. That's strength. Too much of it can lead to hatred, and from there it's one slippery step to self-damnation. But never underestimate the empowering strength of the right sort of anger. The others were listening now, more than one of them nodding in silent agreement, and Pater felt himself nodding back.
You're in a unique position, Father, Birkett said after a moment. Of course, all of us are in unique positions. It comes with being unique human beings. But the consequences of your position, or rather, of the actions of someone in your position, are going to be greater and affect far more people more profoundly than most priests ever have the opportunity to accomplish. You're aware of that. In fact, I'm fairly confident that your awareness of it was one of the things helping to get your own spiritual balance out of balance. You've been spending too much of your time and strength trying to shoulder your responsibilities, trying to reach ahead and figure out what those responsibilities were, rather than simply letting God show you. He does that, you know, sometimes directly, by laying his finger on your heart, and sometimes by sending others of his children to pull you out of the ditch you've fallen into, or to point you in a direction which wouldn't have occurred to you on your own. I know, Pater smiled at the old man, then turned his head, allowing his smile to take in all the brethren seated about them. I know. But do you think he sent me to you simply to be pulled out of the ditch, or to be pointed in another direction as well? You wouldn't happen to have any spiritual road maps in your library, would you, Father Zahn?
Now that's a profound sort of question. The sort of thing I might have expected out of a Schulerite.
Birkett smiled back and cuffed the younger priest gently on the side of his head.
And, like any profound question, I'm sure it has a profound answer. Somewhere. But only time will tell, I suppose.
His smile turned softer, and the hand which had smacked Pater's head so lightly moved to cup the side of his face instead.
Only time will tell.
May, Year of God, 895. 1. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands.
"Well, you were right, Robert,"
Zaspar Clintan said caustically.
"I know I feel a whole lot better now that we've gotten the complete report, don't you?"
The Grand Inquisitor's sarcasm was even more biting than usual. Not that it came as a surprise. In fact, if Robert Duchesne was surprised by anything, it was that Clintan wasn't throwing a full-fledged tantrum. Of course there's time for that still, he reminded himself. We're only just getting started. Langhorne knows where he's going to go before we get finished this afternoon.
No, Zaspar, he said as calmly as he could. It doesn't make me feel much better.
It does confirm some things, though, including the fact that Elaine's plan to misdirect the Carisians seems to have worked. I can't believe someone like Caleb would have sent less than 30 of his ships to intercept 130 of our own if he hadn't been caught completely on the wrong foot.
Why not? Clintan demanded bitterly. Their less than 30 seem to have kicked our 130's ass pretty damn thoroughly.
He glared at Maguire.
They didn't need to send any more ships than they did. God, it's pathetic.
Zaspar, Duchesne said,
You can't blame men for losing a battle when they suddenly come up against a weapon that causes their own ships to blow up under them. Especially when they didn't have any idea it was coming. I don't know about you, but if I expected someone to be firing round shot at me, and instead they were firing some kind of ammunition that exploded the minute it hit my ship, I'd find that fairly disconcerting. In fact, I'd find it downright terrifying. The fucking cowards were supposed to be temple guardsmen, Clinton snarled, his face darkening dangerously. He seemed even angrier than the failure of one of his plans usually made him feel. They're God's own warriors, damn it, not little children seeing fireworks for the first time. Duchenne started to fire back a quick, angry response, but he caught himself in time. Pushing Clintan over the brink would do nothing but get someone killed. Still, perhaps you're right about that, the treasurer said, instead of what he had started to say. At the same time, do you think it would really have made a lot of difference if Harper had tried to fight to the last ship? Clintan looked at him incredulously, and Duchenne held up both hands. All right, I'll give you that if they had, the Carizians wouldn't have gained all the ships that surrendered. I have to say, though, that reading Sea Rose's report, I don't see how Harper could have kept his ships from striking their colours however hard he had tried. I'm not condoning their cowardice, Zaspar. I'm simply saying that human nature being human nature, Harper couldn't have stopped it. Not when the Carizians' new weapons came as a total surprise. I am getting damn sick and tired of every fucking new Carizian weapon coming as a total surprise, Clinton grated. If it's any consolation, I think this one must have been pretty close to a surprise for the Carizians too, Duchenne replied. What the hell are you talking about now? Clinton demanded. I think it's pretty obvious. They haven't had it for very long, Duchenne said. If they had, we'd have already seen it in action. For that matter, they wouldn't have tried something as desperate as a point-blank engagement in the middle of the night. If they had the ability to stand off and fire these explosive shot or whatever they are, why should they have closed? They sailed right into the middle of our ships. So close, they were fighting old-fashioned boarding action, Zaspar. It's right here in Sea Rose's report. So what? Clinton waved a dismissive hand. Robert has a point, Elaine Megware said. The Grand Inquisitor rounded on him, but Megware stood his ground. I've read the reports too, Zaspar. Everything the Carizians have done from Armageddon Reef and Crag Reach has been built around artillery, not boarding actions. Oh, there've been boarding actions in most of the engagements, but they were the exceptions. Either that, or they were the tidying up, taking prizes which had already been battered into effective surrender with the guns. And the main reasons that's been the case are that the Carizians are more experienced than almost anyone else they've fought, and that they have less manpower than we do. However good they may be in boarding melees, the last thing they want to do is to come to us in the kind of fight that lets us trade casualties one for one with them, and they've built all their tactics around avoiding that kind of battle. But that's exactly what they were doing against Harper's fleet. Sure it was, until they turned around and blew the shit out of him, Clinton said impatiently. That's not what Elaine's trying to tell you, Zaspar. Somehow Duchenne managed to keep his frustration out of his tone. What he's telling you is that an outnumbered Carizian fleet fought our kind of battle, until it managed to get the bulk of Harper's fleet into artillery range. They didn't switch to this new weapon until then, and they have to have taken serious casualties before they did. That suggests that whatever it is they were using, they didn't have a lot of it. They decided they had to make every shot count, and the only way to do that was to come to us, take their licks on the way in, and hope they could finish us off with one or two good, heavy punches once they got inside our reach. Clinton glowered at him. but from the Grand Inquisitor's expression, there was at least a possibility his brain was beginning to work. It might even be beginning to work well enough to overcome his ire, although Duchesne wouldn't have cared to bet on the possibility.
"I think Robert's right, Zaspar," Maigret said now. "There's no way we can know how much they actually had of whatever special ammunition they were using, but the indications are that they didn't have anywhere near as much of it as they would have liked. From Sea Rose's report, it's obvious he doesn't know what percentage of their total fleet had it, but he says he personally saw at least four of their galleons, which were still firing normal round shot even after our ships had started to explode. As a matter of fact, I was impressed by the fact that he was able to keep his wits about himself well enough to notice that. And that's one reason I think Elaine's misdirection with the sailing orders actually worked," Duchesne said, piling on while the piling was good. "If they only had a handful of ships which were able to use this weapon, for whatever reason, then they would certainly have concentrated as many as possible of their regular galleons to support that handful. They didn't. To me, that seems to indicate their spies did pick up Harper's original orders to sail west. They must have sent a major portion of their fleet east in response to that. It's the only explanation for why they didn't close in on Harper with everything they had." "What about that blockade of theirs?" Clinton challenged in a marginally calmer tone. "According to Jarras and Coleman, they must have had at least 40 galleons off the Gulf of Jarras. Maybe that's where your missing ships were."
"It could have been, but I don't think it was," Maigret said. "I've been going over their reports too, and they never actually saw the majority of those war galleons at all. What they saw were masts and sails on the horizon. And don't forget the way Harald used merchant galleons to convince Blackwater that Caleb's galleons were with his fleet in the Sea of Kyrus when they were actually off ambushing Malachi off Armageddon Reef. I think this may have been more of the same, and I don't really see how anyone can blame them for being fooled under the circumstances."
"Maybe," Clinton said grudgingly.
"It works with what we know of the timing," Duchesne said, nodding at Maigret. "Their spy network's obviously as good as we thought it was. We fooled them with Elaine's original orders, and that drew their main fleet out of position. But then their spies realized we'd misled them and reported Harper's real sailing orders in time for them to realize what was happening. Only they still didn't have time to get recall orders to the ships they'd already sent off. So they put together a fleet of merchant galleons to convince Jarras and Coleman they couldn't fight their way out to sea while they scraped up everything they had, including the handful of ships they could equip with their new weapon, and threw them directly into Harper's teeth. If their weapon hadn't worked, we would have had them, Zaspar. It's that simple. And that's how close we came to accomplishing exactly what you originally proposed to do." For a moment, he was afraid that last sentence had been too blatant an appeal to Clinton's ego. But then he saw the Grand Inquisitor nodding slowly and more thoughtfully. Clinton didn't look one bit less angry, but at least he had lost some of the dangerous, saw-toothed rage which had been riding him with spurs of fire.
"All right," he said. "But even if you're right, the fact remains that we've suffered yet another defeat at the hands of heretics and apostates. The way we seem to keep stumbling from one disaster to another is bound to have an impact on even the most faithful if it goes on long enough. In fact, my Inquisitor's reports indicate that that process may already have begun."
"That's a serious concern," Samson Trinair said, entering the conversation for the first time. Duchesne tried not to glare at the Chancellor, but he supposed it was better Trinair should come late to the party than stay home entirely.
"That's a very serious concern," Trinair repeated now,
Or do you mean the process may have already begun, Zaspa?
We're not seeing a sudden upsurge in heresy, if that's what you're worried about, Clintan said. Aside, of course, he darted a venomous look at Duchenne and Trinaire, from the increasing number of reformists surfacing in Cidamarck, that is. But what we are seeing is what I suppose it would be fairest to call demoralization. People are seeing that despite the fact that we hugely outnumber the heretics, they keep winning battle after battle. Despite our best efforts, the casualty and prisoner totals from this latest debacle are going to get out, you know, and when they do, people are going to compare them to how little we've had to show for our efforts to date. Don't think for a moment that it isn't going to encourage the weak-hearted to feel even more despondent. In fact, it's likely to start undermining support for the jihad in general, at the very least. He paused for a moment, letting his eyes circle the table. It's going to begin to undermine confidence in the jihad's direction. Duchenne felt Trinaire and Maigret settle into sudden, frozen stillness. There was no mistaking Clintan's implication.
I scarcely think, the treasurer said into the silence, choosing his words with excruciating care, that anyone within the vicarate is likely to challenge our direction of the jihad. After all, he added silently, you've slaughtered anybody who might have the courage or the wit to breathe a word about how thoroughly we've bungled things, haven't you, Zaspar?
I'm not talking about the vicarate.
There was something smug and ugly about the Grand Inquisitor's assurance, Duchenne thought. But then Clintan continued.
I'm worried about people outside the vicarate. I'm worried about all the bastards in Cidamarck and Silkia who are going their merry way, violating the embargo every day. I'm worried about the upsurge in reformist propaganda that's turning up in Cidamarck and other realms, according to my inquisitors. Places like Dolar and Desnare, for example, even the Temple Lands. And I'm worried about people who are going to lose heart because Mother Church seems unwilling to reach out her hand and smite the ungodly.
We've been trying to smite the ungodly, Duchenne pointed out, trying to disguise the sinking sensation he felt. The problem is that it hasn't been working out very well despite our best efforts.
The problem, Clintan said, his tone and expression both unyielding, is that we haven't reached out to the ungodly we can reach, the ungodly right here on the mainland.
Like who, Zaspa? Trinaire asked.
Like Stoner and his bastard friends for one, Clintan shot back.
His lips twisted, but then he made them untwist with a visible act of will.
But that's all right. I understand why we can't touch them right now. The three of you have made that abundantly clear. I won't pretend it doesn't piss me off, and I won't pretend I don't think it's ultimately a mistake. But I'm willing to concede the point, for now at least, where Cidamarck and Silkia are concerned.
Duchenne's heart plunged as he realized where Clintan was headed. He couldn't even pretend it was a surprise, despite the sickness in his belly.
I'm talking about those prisoners Thirsk took last year, Clintan went on flatly.
The ones he somehow persistently managed not to hand over to the Inquisition or send to the Temple.
They're heretics, Zamsin. They're rebels against God himself, taken in the act of rebellion. My God, man, how much more evidence do you need? If Mother Church can't act against them, then who can she act against? Do you think there aren't thousands, millions of people who aren't asking themselves that very question right this moment?
I understand what you're talking about, Zaspar, Maigret said cautiously. But Thirsk and Bishop Stephen have a point as well. If we deliver men who surrender to us to the Inquisition to suffer the question and the punishment of Shula as they ought, then what happens to our men who try to surrender to them? Mother Church and the Inquisition cannot allow themselves to be swayed from their clear duty by such concerns, Clintan said, in that same flat, unyielding tone. Should the heretics choose to mistreat our warriors, to abuse the true sons of God who fall into their power, then that blood will be on their hands, not ours. We can only do what the Book of Shula and all the rest of the writ call upon us to do, and trust in God and the archangels. No one ever told us that doing God's will would be easy, but that makes it no less our duty and responsibility to do it. In fact, we ought... He stopped, clapping his mouth shut, and Duchenne felt the despair of defeat. Maigret wasn't going to support him, despite what he'd just said. Not when a part of him agreed with Clintan to begin with, and especially not when the Grand Inquisitor had just made his fury over what had happened in the Markovian Sea so abundantly clear. And Trinair wasn't going to argue with Clintan either, partly because he too agreed with the Inquisitor, but even more because of what Clintan had just stopped short of saying. He's offering a quid pro quo where Sidamark and Silkia are concerned, Duchenne thought bitterly. He's not putting it into so many words, but Zamsin understands him just fine anyway, and without at least one of them to back me, I can't argue with him either. If I try, I'll lose, and all I'll accomplish will be to burn one more bridge with him. It was true, every word of it, and the treasurer knew it. Just as he knew the demand for the Carisian prisoners to be shipped to Zion would be sent out that very afternoon. But somehow knowing he couldn't have stopped it, even if he had tried, didn't make him feel one bit less guilty and dirty for not trying after all. "May I ask how the meeting went, Your Grace?" Willem Reynow, Archbishop of Chiangwu, inquired a bit cautiously. He was almost certainly the only person in Zion who would have dared to ask that question at all, given the rumours circulating through the temple about Gregor Seerose's written report. He was also, however, the adjutant of the Order of Shula, which made him the Grand Inquisitor's second in command in both the Order and the Office of Inquisition. The two of them had worked closely together for almost 2 decades, and if there'd been one person in the world whom Clintan had truly been prepared to trust, that person would have been Reynow. "Actually," Clintan said with a smile which would have astonished any of his fellows among the group of four, given the tone of the meeting which had just ended, "it went well, Willem, quite well. We'll be able to move against the heretic prisoners in Gorath then, Your Grace?" Reynow's tone brightened, and Clintan nodded. "Yes," he replied, then grimaced. "I had to go ahead and more or less promise, again, to keep our hands off Sidamark and Silkia." He shrugged. "We knew going in that that was going to happen. Of course, my esteemed colleagues don't have to know everything we're up to now, do they?" "No, Your Grace," Reynow murmured. He wondered how many of the rest of the group of four realized the extent to which Clintan used his well-earned reputation for bull-headed refusal to compromise and fiery temper to manipulate them. It had taken even Reynow years to discover that at least half that reputation was a weapon the Grand Inquisitor had crafted deliberately, with careful forethought. Its true effectiveness depended on the reality of the fury hiding so close beneath its wielder's surface, of course, but on his bare-knuckled climb to the Grand Inquisitorship, Zaspar Clintan had discovered that while intolerance and ambition might make him hated, it was his passionate temper which made him feared. He had learned to use that temper, not simply to be used by it, to batter opponents into submission, and the technique had served him well. It was a brute force approach, but it was also only one of the many weapons in his arsenal, as one unfortunate victim after another had discovered.
"What can you tell me about this new weapon C-Rose is blathering about?" Clintan asked, with one of the abrupt changes of subject for which he was famous.
"Our engines in Caris continue to fare poorly." Reno didn't like admitting that, yet there was no use pretending otherwise. "Wave Thunder's organization obviously has Shanwei's own luck, but I'm afraid there's no point pretending he isn't extremely competent, Your Grace, as well. Every effort to build an actual network, even among the loyalists in Old Caris, has failed."
"That wasn't the question I asked," Clintan pointed out.
"I realize that, Your Grace," Reno responded calmly. "It was more in the nature of a prefatory remark." Clintan's lips twitched on the brink of a smile. He was well aware of the extent to which Reno managed him, and he was perfectly content to go right on being managed, within limits, and as long as Reno produced results. "What I was going to say," the Archbishop continued, "is that our original hypothesis appears to be correct. According to one of the very few agents we have in place, the Carisians are casting what amounts to hollow round shot and filling the cavities with gunpowder. What he hasn't been able to confirm is how they're getting them to explode, although he's offered a couple of theories which sound to my admittedly untrained ear as if they make sense." Neither of them chose to mention the fact that Clintan had somehow failed to keep Elaine Maguire informed of those agents' reports.
"What are the chances of having him dig more deeply into the matter?"
"I would advise against that, Your Grace. The agent we're talking about is Harrison." Clintan's grunt was an acceptance of Reynard's advice. Harrison was the code name they'd assigned to one of their tiny handful of sources within the kingdom of Old Caris. As Reno had pointed out, every effort to establish a formal network in Old Caris, indeed almost anywhere in the accursed empire of Caris, had run into one stone wall after another. Sometimes it was almost enough to make Clintan truly believe in demonic interference on the other side. As a result of that unending sequence of failures, however, the sources which were available to them were more precious than jewels. That was why they'd been assigned code names, which Clintan insisted on using, even in his conversations with Reno. In fact, he'd made a point of never learning what the sources' actual names might be, on the theory that what he didn't know, he couldn't disclose, even by accident. While he hated to admit it, Maguire and that gutless fool Duchern did have a point about the apparent effectiveness of Carisian spies. He didn't believe any of them were managing to operate within the temple itself, but they had to be operating, and operating effectively, throughout the temple lands. It was the only explanation for how so many clerics, or their families at least, could have escaped the Inquisition when he broke the Wilson's group, or how the Carisians could have discovered that Cornelis Harper's fleet was actually going east instead of west, for that matter. And that being the case, he wasn't going to take a chance on anyone's learning the identities of those precious sources of information. All their surviving sources had been strictly ordered to recruit no other agents. That reduced their reach, since it meant each and every one of those agents could report only what he or she actually saw or heard. It also meant each of them required his or her individual conduit back to the temple, which made the transmission of anything they learned even slower and more cumbersome than it would already have been across such vast distances. Unfortunately, as Reno had just said, every agent who had attempted to recruit others to build any sort of true network had been pounced on within weeks. It had taken a while for the Inquisition to realize that was happening, but once it had become evident, the decision to change their operational patterns had virtually made itself. And onerous as the restrictions might be, anything which made the spies they had managed to put or keep in place less likely to attract Wave Thunder's attention was thoroughly worthwhile. Harrison was a special case, even among that tiny handful of assets, however. He hadn't been placed in Kairos at all. He'd been born there. A temple loyalist horrified by his kingdom's heresy, he'd found his way to communicate with the Inquisition, and virtually all those communications flowed only in one direction, from him to the temple. He had established his own channels, including one which would let them communicate back to him in an excruciatingly slow and roundabout fashion, although he'd also cautioned them that it could be used only sparingly, if there was no other choice. He was prepared to provide all the information he could, he had told them from the outset, but if they expected him to avoid the detection which had befallen so many other agents and loyalists, they would have to settle for what he could tell them, and for his maintaining control of their communications. That had been more than enough to make Clintan and Reyno suspicious initially, since both of them were well aware of how much damage a double agent could do by feeding them false information. But Harrison had been reporting for almost 3 years now without their detecting a single falsehood, and he'd been promoted by his superiors twice during that time, giving him better and better access. Besides that, he was crucial to one of Clintan's central strategies. That was the main reason he'd been given the codename Harrison, after one of the greatest mortal heroes of the war against Shanwei's disciples at the dawn of creation.
"Did he have anything else for us in the same report?" the Grand Inquisitor asked. "Anything specific to what happened to Harper?"
"Not specific to that, no, Your Grace." Reyno shook his head. "There's no mention at all of that battle in his message. I judge it was probably composed before the battle was even fought, or before any report of it had reached Harrison, at any rate. He does say Mondrain's been in discussion about ship designs with Oliver, though. And he's heard rumours Seamount and Mondrain are working with Houseman on further improving these new projectiles. Shells, they're calling them, as well as continuing to experiment with new cannon-founding techniques. Whatever they're up to, though, they're keeping the information very confidential, and Harrison's promotion means he's no longer in a position to see any of their internal correspondence."
Clintan grunted again, less happily this time. Harrison's sketches of things like the new Carisian hollow-based bullets, flintlock mechanisms, and artillery cartridges had been of immense value. He'd managed to provide the formula for the Carisian's gunpowder, which not only caused less fouling, but was rather more powerful than Mother Church's had been, and the new techniques for producing granular powder as well. Of course, the Inquisition had been forced to take great care in how it made that information available to the Temple Guard and the secular lords, lest it betray the fact that it had an agent placed to obtain it in the first place. It had, however, given Clintan invaluable advance notice on the innovations he had to justify under the prescriptions of Zhou Zheng.
"And that insufferable bastard Wilson," he growled now as the thought of the prescriptions drew his mind into a familiar groove.
"Harrison has seen very little of him personally." Reyno kept his tone as clinical as possible. Clintan's hatred for the Wilson family had become even more obsessive over the last year. Bad enough that Samuel and Howard Wilson, the two men he had hated most in all the world, had escaped the question and the punishment by dying before they could be taken into custody. Worse, that Samuel's wife and children had escaped the Inquisition completely. Yet worse than any of that, except in a purely personal sense, of course, was Pater Wilson's desertion to the heresy. He had actually agreed to continue serving,
as Michael Stainer's intendant, and not content with that, he'd even assumed direction of the Carisian Shanway-spawned patent office. A member of Clintan's own order was actively abetting the flood of innovations that had allowed the renegade kingdom to escape the justly deserved destruction the Grand Inquisitor had decreed for it in the first place. He has managed to confirm, however, that Madame Wilson and her children have reached Tellersburg, Your Grace, Reynaud added delicately, and Clintan's face turned dangerously dark. For a moment, it looked as if the Grand Inquisitor might launch into one of his more furious tirades, but he stopped and controlled himself instead. "I suppose we'll just have to hope he's in his office at the wrong time," he said. Then he shook his head. "Actually, I hope he isn't. I don't want that son of Shanway slipping through our hands the way his father and his uncle did. He has far too much to atone for by simply dying on us." "As you say, Your Grace," Reynaud murmured with a slight bow. "Very well." Clintan's nostrils flared as he inhaled. Then he shook himself. "The Sword of Shula?" "That operation is slightly behind schedule, Your Grace. I'm afraid it's taking a bit longer, partly because the winter was so severe, to lay the groundwork properly. But we're also encountering more delays than we'd anticipated in finding the properly receptive sons of Mother Church. We're making steady progress now, however. The organization is going well, and I hope to be able to have everything in place in the next month or two. In the meantime, our inquisitors have confirmed that Khanier, at least, is in Sidar City. They're not certain how he got there, and no one's figured out how he managed to get out of Glacier Heart in the first place, but he's increasingly visible in reformist circles. And our good friend Stonar remains blissfully unaware of his presence, I suppose," Clintan sneered.
"So it would appear, Your Grace," Reynaud smiled thinly. "For such a successful ruler, the Lord Protector appears to be singularly ill-informed about events in his own realm. Or perhaps I should say, he appears selectively ill-informed. Archbishop Predwin is still en route to Cedar, but Bishop Executor Baker reports that he's pointedly drawn Lord Protector Gregor's attention to the growing boldness of reformist heretics in the Republic. In return, the Lord Protector has assured the Bishop Executor that his guardsmen are doing all they can to assist the Inquisition in dealing with the regrettable situation." His eyes met Clintan's, and they grimaced almost in unison. "Unfortunately," Reynaud continued, "all of his efforts to assist Bishop Executor Baker have failed. Despite his guard's very best efforts, even fairly notorious reformists seem to slip away before they can be taken into custody. Indeed, it's almost as if they were being warned by someone that they're about to be arrested. And so far, despite the persistent reports of Kainer's presence in the capital, he continues to elude the authorities." Clintan made a harsh sound deep in his throat. The Inquisition had always relied heavily on secular rulers to assist in the suppression of heresy. Not even Mother Church could produce sufficient manpower to police all of Safehold against such dangerous thoughts and movements, and the system had worked well over the centuries. Yet that neatly summed up the problem they faced now. The Grand Inquisitor thought grimly, because it was no longer working, and no Grand Inquisitor, including him, had seen the current breakdown coming. He'd been caught as unawares by it as anyone, and though he was expanding the Order of Shula as rapidly as he could, it took years to properly train an Inquisitor. In the meantime, he continued to have no choice but to rely on the secular authorities, and too many of those authorities were clearly more interested in hampering the Inquisition than in aiding it.
Perhaps Archbishop Praedwin will be able to inspire the Lord Protector to be of somewhat greater assistance, he said, then smiled. And if he can't, there's always the sword of Shula, isn't there?
Indeed, Your Grace, Raynor agreed with an answering smile.
And Operation Rakurai?
The men have been selected, Raynor said in a much graver voice. All of them have been carefully examined and vetted, Your Grace, and I have their dossiers for you to consider at your convenience. The arrangements to deliver them are almost complete as well. Once you've made your final selections, we'll be able to move rapidly to put them in place.
You're satisfied with them?
With all of them, Your Grace, Raynor replied firmly. We haven't told any of them exactly what Rakurai will entail, of course. I've tried to provide you with at least twice the number of recruits you requested in order to give you the greatest possible latitude in making your final choices. In addition, of course, I'm sure we'll be able to find other uses for men with such deep faith and fervour. But as you've so rightly stressed from the beginning, security is of critical importance for this mission especially. We can't afford to have anyone not directly involved in it privy to any of its details.
But you're confident all of them will be willing to undertake the mission when the time comes?
I'm certain of it, Your Grace. These men are truly committed to the will of God, and to the Archangel's service and Mother Church, and they know abomination when they see it. The Archbishop shook his head. They won't flinch in the face of Shan Wei herself, Your Grace, far less the prospect of any mortal foe.
Good, Willem, Saspa Clintan said softly. Good.
2. HMS Royal Caris 58 and Archbishop's Palace, City of Tellersberg, Kingdom of Old Caris.
Thank God,
Naaman Bates said with quiet, heartfelt fervour as he watched the Tellersberg waterfront creep steadily, if slowly, closer.
I've come to the conclusion, all of Naaman Garrett's dreadful novels about buccaneer kingdoms notwithstanding, that while I may be an island prince, I'm not a swashbuckling one.
Don't worry, Caleb Armack reassured him. I doubt anyone's going to expect you to be one. In fact, the mind boggles at the thought.
Oh? Naaman looked at his emperor with raised eyebrows. Are you implying that I cut a less than romantic figure, Your Majesty? Heavens no!
Caleb looked shocked at the suggestion. As a matter of fact, I think you cut a much more romantic figure than you did before we left Geraith.
Or a considerably thinner one, anyway.
Don't tease him, Your Majesty, Princess Olivia scolded. And as for you, Naaman, you cut quite romantic enough a figure for me. And I'd better not catch you cutting romantic figures for anyone else.
Somehow I don't think you're saving him from being teased, Olivia, Caleb pointed out.
I didn't say I was trying to, with all due respect, Your Majesty. I was simply pointing out that he belongs to me. If there's any teasing to do, I'll do it. Caleb smiled. Although it was true, Naaman had dropped quite a few pounds during the long, strenuous voyage. He didn't doubt for a moment that the Emeraldian could scarcely wait to get his feet on dry land once more. If the truth be told, Caleb was more anxious than usual to get ashore himself. The trip from Chisholm had been the most exhausting voyage he could remember, with one ugly storm after another, and his role as a mere passenger had kept him effectively confined below decks the entire time. For some reason, Captain Gerard seemed to object to having his sovereign on the quarterdeck when everyone had to be lashed into place with lifelines. After the first couple of real blows, Caleb had discovered he lacked the heart to overrule the captain's obviously sincere and worried objections, and accepted his banishment below. Not that the captain hadn't had a valid point, he supposed. The mountainous seas had frequently reared as high as 25 or 30 feet, and their power had been mind-numbing. The unending succession of impacts had left Royal Kara's crew and passengers feeling as if they'd been beaten black and blue, and the ship's carpenter had been kept busy dealing with a host of minor repairs. The bosun had been kept busy as well, as sails and gear carried away aloft, and one of their escorting galleons had disappeared for 3 days. If not for the imagery from Merlin's snarks, Caleb would have assumed she'd gone down, and at one point, as his flagship had driven before the wind under nothing but bare poles, giving up heartbreaking miles of her hard-won western progress, he hadn't been at all sure Royal Caris wasn't going to founder herself. A point he'd been very careful not to discuss with Charlian at the time. The main reason he wanted to off the ship, though, had nothing to do with all of that and everything to do with the tasks awaiting him. One of them, in particular, promised to be especially ticklish, and the timing window for it was going to be interesting. He watched the oared galleys that served as tugs, rowing strongly out to meet his flagship, and heard the cheers of welcome rising from their companies, and his smile grew a bit broader. "Just be patient, Narman," he said soothingly. "We'll have you ashore in no time. Unless one of those tugs accidentally rams us and sinks us, of course." Sir Regis Yowance, Duke of Grey Harbour, was generally recognised as the first councillor of the Empire of Caris, although the title tended to change off with Baron Green Mountain when the court was in Charaeth. Now he stood watching the galleys nudge Royal Caris closer to the Stone Quay, and felt a vast surge of relief. Throwing lines flew ashore, followed by thick hawsers that dropped over the waiting bollards. The ship took tension on the mooring hawsers with her own capstans, fenders squeaked and groaned between her and the quay's tall side, and a gangplank went across to her bulwark-level entry port. Grey Harbour had commanded his own ship in his time, and he recognised the signs of heavy weather when he saw them. Much of the galleon's paint had been stripped away to expose patches of raw wood. Sea slime streaked her hull. One of her quarterboats was missing the falls lashed tightly across the davits where the sea had stove in the vanished boat. The railing of her sternwalk had been badly damaged. Two of her topsails had the newer, less stained look of replacement canvas, and one of her forward gunport lids had been replaced by the ship's carpenter. The bare, unpainted wood looked like a missing tooth in the neat row of the galleon's gunports. And as he looked at the other four galleons of her escort, he saw equal or worse signs of how hard their voyage had been.
"I know that boy has an iron stomach," the Earl reflected, "but I'll bet even he had his anxious moments on this one. Thank God I didn't know anything about it until he got here. I've got grey hairs enough as it is."
Grey Harbour knew he tended to worry about what Caleb airily called the details of keeping the Empire running. That was his job when it came down to it, and he was well aware that whatever Caleb might call them, the Emperor knew exactly how important they truly were. Nonetheless, there were times he felt a distinct temptation to say, "I told you so," and looking at the battered ship at quayside was definitely one of those moments.
"I don't care how much sense it made from a diplomatic perspective," he thought now, sourly. "This nonsense about their spending half the year here in Tellersburg and the other half in Charaeth is just that, nonsense. Ships sink, even the best of them sometimes, damish, and if anyone should have known that, it's Caleb Armagh. But no, he had to throw that into the marriage proposal too, and then he and Charlie and Alana go sailing back and forth on the same damn ship. So if it sinks, we lose all three of them." He knew he was being silly, and he didn't really care. Not at the moment. And he didn't feel any particular responsibility to be rational either. Certainly, this time, Charlian was on a different ship. But that only meant she'd have the opportunity to sink on her own on the way back from Coruscant, assuming, he reminded himself,
HMS Dawn Star hadn't already sunk somewhere in the Chisholm Sea, taking Empress and Crown Princess with her.
Oh, stop that!
He shook his head, feeling his disapproving frown disappearing into a grin, as Caleb Armagh came bounding down the gangplank, in complete disregard of the careful formality of an emperor's proper arrival in his capital city. The trumpeters, as surprised as anyone by Caleb's diversion from the anticipated order of disembarkation, began a belated fanfare as the youthful monarch's feet found the key. Half the assembled courtiers looked offended, another quarter looked surprised, and the remainder were roaring as lustily with laughter as any of the galleon seamen or watching longshoremen.
"You're not going to change them, and even if you could, you know you really wouldn't," Grey Harbour told himself. "Besides, it's part of the magic, and..."
His expression sobered.
"It's part of their legend, part of what makes this whole thing work. And they wouldn't have it if God hadn't given it to them. So why don't you just do what they obviously do and trust God to go on getting it right?" "Welcome home, Your Mat," he began, starting a formal bow, only to be interrupted as a pair of powerful arms, which were obviously as unconcerned with protocol as the rest of the Emperor, enveloped him in a huge hug. "It's good to be home, Regis," a voice said in his ear. The arms around him tightened, two sinewy hands thumped him once each on the back hard, and then Caleb stood back. He laid those hands on Grey Harbour's shoulders, looking into his face, and smiled that enormous, infectious Armagh smile. "What say you and I get back to the palace out of all this racket?"
He twitched his head to take in the cheering crowds, who were doing their best to deafen everyone in Telesburg,
"and find ourselves some tall, cold drinks while we catch each other up on all the news." "Thank you for joining us, Peter," Archbishop Michael Stainer said, as Brian Ushar ushered Peter Wilson into his office once again.
The intendant began to smile in acknowledgement, but then his face went suddenly neutral as he realized Heinrich Wagner, the elderly bishop of Telesburg, and Emperor Caleb were already present.
"As you can see," Stainer continued, watching Wilson's expression, "we've been joined by a couple of additional guests. That's because we have something rather unusual to discuss with you. Something which may require quite a lot of convincing, I'm afraid, so please come in and have a seat. You too, Brian."
Ushire seemed unsurprised by the invitation, and he touched Wilson's elbow, startling the young Schulerite back into motion. The two of them crossed to Stainer's desk to kiss his ring respectfully, then settled into two of the three still unoccupied chairs arranged to face the Archbishop and his other guests.
"Allow me to add my thanks to Michael's father," Caleb said, "and not just for joining us today. I'm well aware of how much my house and my kingdom, the entire empire, owe to your compassion and open-mindedness. To be honest, that awareness is one of the reasons for this meeting."
"I beg your pardon, Your Majesty?"
Wilson's expression was a combination of surprise and puzzlement. The Emperor had arrived back in Telesburg only yesterday afternoon, and with all that had happened since he and the Empress had left old Caerus for Chisholm, there must have been a virtual whirlwind of details and decisions requiring his attention. So what was he doing anywhere except the halls of Telesburg Palace? If he wanted to meet with Archbishop Michael or any of the rest of them, he could easily have summoned them to the palace rather than meeting them here. For that matter, how had he gotten to Archbishop Michael's office without anyone noticing it? And where were the Imperial Guardsmen who should be keeping an eye on him? In answer to one of the several questions I'm sure are swirling around inside that active brain of yours, Caleb said, "there's a tunnel between Telesburg Palace and the cathedral. It's been there for the better part of 2 centuries now, and I'm not the first monarch who's made use of it. Admittedly,
We're using it quite a bit more now than we used to. And we never made use of the tunnel between the cathedral and the Archbishop's palace before the, recent change in management. He smiled infectiously. I wouldn't be a bit surprised to discover there were similar tunnels between a lot of cathedrals and a lot of palaces. Prince Narman's confirmed that there's one in a race store, at any rate. I see, Your Majesty. Wilson knew his voice still sounded puzzled, and Caleb chuckled. You see that much, you mean, Father, he said. You're still at sea about the rest of it, though, aren't you? I'm afraid so, Your Majesty, Wilson admitted. All will become clear shortly, Father. In fact, the Emperor's expression sobered suddenly. A great many things are about to become clear to you. Before we get into that, however, Michael has a few things to say to you. Caleb sat back in his chair, passing the conversation over to the Archbishop, and Wilson turned to look at the head of the Church of Caris.
What we're about to tell you, Father, Stainer's voice was as sober as the Emperor's expression, is going to come as a shock. In fact, even someone with your faith is going to find parts of it very difficult to believe, or to accept, at least. And I know from personal, first-hand experience, believe me, that it will completely change the way in which you look at the world. The decision to tell you wasn't lightly made, nor was it made solely by the men you see in this room at this moment. The truth is that I sent you to St. Zerno's for more than one reason, my son. I did send you there because of the spiritual crisis you faced, and I was absolutely honest with you when I told you I'd experienced a similar crisis many years ago and found answers to it at St. Zerno's. What I didn't tell you at that time was the way in which what I learned at St. Zerno's changed my faith. I believe it broadened and deepened that faith. Yet honesty compels me to say it might just as easily have destroyed my belief forever had it been presented to me in even a slightly different fashion. And the second reason I sent you to Father Zahn and Father Abel was to give them the opportunity to meet you, to come to know you, to be brutally honest, to evaluate you, and how you might react to the same knowledge.